From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
If you watch the Fox News Channel, which I would not recommend, that they do not use fair and balanced very much anymore, and because it's embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. But I think the judge may have inadvertently given them their new slogan, the Fox News Channel, wholly without merit.
Al Franken, author of Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, recounts his saga with Fox, who sued him for using their copyrighted term, fair and balanced. And in Madison, Wisconsin as well, we speak with Naomi Klein on her piece, Iraq is Not America's to Sell. Finally, a Pakistani man who was held on Guantanamo for more than a year sues the U.S. and Pakistani governments. We'll speak with his lawyer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the U.S. has resumed aerial bombing raids on Iraqi targets for the first time in 6 months. On Friday, 500-pound bombs were dropped on Tikrit. The bombing resumed on Sunday when U.S. troops bombed portions of Fallujah. Friday's bombing came shortly after Iraqi resistance fighters shot down a U.S. Black Hawk helicopter, killing six Americans aboard. The total number of U.S. troops killed in Iraq is just shy of 400. 38 troops have died in the first 10 days of November. In other Iraqi news, the Washington Post reports the U.S. is now considering replacing the Iraqi Governing Council with another form of governing council. The Bush administration is reportedly upset with the failure of the U.S.-appointed council to address many of the key problems in Iraq. Among the members on the council is Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress. One U.S. official told the Washington Post we're unhappy with all of them. They're not acting as a legislative or governing body, and we need to get moving. The White House is sending former Ambassador Robert Blackwell to Iraq this week. Blackwell is the new National Security Council official overseeing the occupation. And the International Red Cross has announced it's pulling out of both Baghdad and Basra due to security concerns. At least 17 people have died in Saudi Arabia following a suicide bombing Saturday on a housing complex in the capital city of Riyadh. U.S. and Saudi officials said members of al-Qaeda opposed to the Saudi monarch were likely behind the attack, which also injured over 100 people. At the time of the bombing, the U.S. had already closed its embassy and two consulates after receiving intelligence that an attack was imminent. In May, 35 people, including eight Americans, died during an attack on a complex that housed foreign workers, including many from the private military firm Vinel. The Wall Street Journal reports Saudi officials have detained 1,500 opponents of the Saudi regime and have increased its already tight control on the kingdom's media. In campaign news, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has announced he'll opt out of the public financing presidential system. He's the first Democrat to do so in 30 years since the taxpayer-funded system was set up after Watergate. In other Dean news, two of the most politically powerful labor unions, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, are both endorsing Dean this week. In news from the John Kerry campaign, the Associated Press is reporting his campaign manager, Jim Jordan, and his campaign chair, Gene Shaheen, have been fired. Ariel Sharon narrowly persuaded the Israeli cabinet yesterday to approve a prisoner swap with the Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah. Under the terms of the deal, Israel would release some 400 Palestinian and 20 Lebanese prisoners in exchange for one live Israeli civilian, Elhanan Tannenbaum, and the remains of three Israeli Defense Force soldiers. Tannenbaum was kidnapped by Hezbollah from an Arab country in October 2000, shortly after the three soldiers were ambushed and abducted on the Israel-Lebanon border. The three have since been declared fallen in action. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration is attempting to prevent a federal court from awarding hundreds of millions of dollars to a group of former American prisoners of war who were tortured in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. A federal court had awarded the former POWs funds from frozen Iraqi assets. And former Vice President Al Gore yesterday lashed out at the Bush administration and urged Congress to repeal the USA Patriot Act. Gore said, quote, "They have taken us much further down the road toward an intrusive Big Brother style government, toward the dangers prophesied by George Orwell in his book 1984 than anyone ever thought would be possible in the United States." And former President Bill Clinton is in China talking about the crisis of AIDS. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Bring Halliburton home, cancel the contracts, ditch the deals, rip up the rules. Just a few of the suggestions for slogans that could help unify the growing movement against the occupation of Iraq. That's the opening sentence in Naomi Klein's piece in the Guardian newspaper, the Guardian of London. She, along with close to 2,000 people, were gathered in Madison, Wisconsin this weekend for a media reform conference. In a little while, we'll go to Al Franken, who was also there. And throughout the week, we'll be playing excerpts of that conference. But right now, to Naomi Klein on her piece, Iraq is Not America's to Sell.
As you know, the global anti-war movement is in the process of shifting gears into becoming an anti-occupation movement. And we saw some large anti-occupation protests on October 25th. And much of the debate has focused on whether the call should be to bring the U.S. troops home or to replace, bring all the foreign troops home or to replace them with international peacekeeping. And I think that's an important debate, but I think that it's missing a really important point, which is that there is another front to the attack on Iraq, to this war. And it's a front that we're not hearing about when we keep hearing that it's a mess, it's a disaster, it's a quagmire, it's a morass, which is the economic front of the war on terror and the attack on Iraq. And that side of the war is actually going very, very well. It's going so well, in fact, that The Economist called the new rules in Iraq a capitalist dream. And described the rules that Paul Bremer, the chief U.S. occupier in Iraq, as a wish list for foreign multinationals. This wish list, which was granted as part of the now infamous Order 39, which was on September 19th, was a transformation of the Iraqi economy, using basically traditional IMF structural adjustment policies, but in one fell swoop. So Order 39 announced that, contrary to Iraq's constitution, which places clear restrictions on foreign ownership of the Iraqi economy and deems essential services protected and not able to be privatized, these were just completely overthrown. And 200 Iraqi state firms were put up for privatization, and foreign firms were allowed 100% ownership of those firms. In addition, they were also given as part of this wish list, the ability to take 100% of their profits out of the country. So all the rules that, you know, are the battleground of, in terms of international trade, were granted. In addition to this, a tax cut for the highest income earners was granted from 45%, which is the tax rate for corporations in Canada, to 15% flat tax. So it really was a wish list, a kind of capitalist dream designed to attract investment, to create investment opportunities. What has become clear is that these contracts are illegal. Now, I think that I'll come back to that, but for the anti-occupation movement, it's important to understand that even if every troop were to come home tomorrow and a so-called sovereign Iraqi government were to come into power, Iraq would still be privatized. It would be privatized by these laws that were written by another country. It would be privatized by foreign companies that would be controlling their essential services. And it would be colonized by the fact that they now have 70% unemployment because of attacks on the public sector. That is colonization. And we need to have this economic analysis. Now, I think, fortunately, it's become very, very clear that we have a very strong weapon in our arsenal in terms of countering this economic occupation of Iraq, and that is that this shock therapy, this structural adjustment of Iraq that is the other side of the war, which is not a mess but is going very, very well, is completely illegal. And this is something that's been reported on in the business press because it's very much of interest to businesses thinking about taking advantage of this wish list. When the Security Council gave their stamp of approval by recognizing the U.S. and Britain as the occupying power in Iraq, they stated very clearly that as occupiers, they needed to abide by the 1907 Hague regulations and the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which govern the rules for an occupying force. What these regulations state very, very clearly is that an occupying power can change laws as it relates to security, but the Hague regulations state that unless absolutely prevented, that's a quote, unless absolutely prevented, the occupying power must respect the laws in the country. Now, the Iraqi constitution explicitly bans this foreign ownership and the privatization of these essential services. So what happened is that Bremer unilaterally overturned the Iraqi constitution, cannot make an argument that he had to do it for security reasons, because they're openly saying that this is part of an economic program, not just for Iraq, but for the whole region, this sort of bundling of free people and free markets. What's starting to happen is that international legal experts are coming forward, not from the left, but from international conservative law firms to say these contracts are extremely risky and they won't be respected. In particular, there's a woman named Juliette Blanche, who is head of energy and international arbitration for the international law firm Norton Rose, which is based in London but has 19 offices around the world, employs 2,000 people, has blue-chip clients like HSBC and even Texaco at certain points. This is a company that has brokered privatizations. I mean, they're not coming from my political perspective, which is that, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that I think that privatizations are a bad idea. They broker privatizations. They represent both government and corporations. And Juliette Blanche has said in the FT, and she said to me in an interview, that these contracts will not stand up in any court because they violate international law. So what she said was that the only legal way out of this bind is the U.S. has to get a regime in Iraq quickly that's pliant enough to ratify the laws. That's the only way that they can make them legal. And as further evidence that the U.S. is trying to attract companies into a very into a legal gray area, not even a gray area, but into a really risky situation economically in Iraq, is that none of the big insurance firms, including the one that Paul Bremer used to work for, Marsh & McLennan, are willing to offer insurance to any companies that want to go and take advantage of what the Wall Street Journal called the Iraq gold rush, because it's just simply considered too risky, not just on security grounds, but on the grounds that if the Iraqi people do get a sovereign government and they decide that they don't actually want their country to be a wholly owned subsidiary of Halliburton or Bechtel, then they will have a serious legal argument to make that these laws that were passed by Bremer were illegal to begin with. And what they can do is change the laws, but more than that, expropriate, renationalize the assets that were privatized in this period of occupation. So if you're Bechtel and you've managed to secure the water contract, or you're Motorola and you've managed to secure the phone contract, these contracts can be overturned by a new Iraqi government, and these assets can be renationalized. And the companies that sign the contracts will not be able to sue in any kind of international court because, of course, by international law, the privatizations were illegal to begin with. That's why their only recourse is to try to get really a puppet regime in power that will ratify. But what's interesting is that there's enough resistance to this economic shock therapy, even among the Bremer-appointed Iraqi council, that it's becoming increasingly unlikely that they'll be able to do this. So what's happening is that somebody needs to insure these companies to go into a very risky situation. So the U.S. Import-Export Bank is being presented, being put forward as the insurer of last resort, which means that they would offer insurance to, say, a Bechtel to come in and privatize the water in Iraq. But then if a new Iraqi government then decides to renationalize that asset, it would be the U.S. taxpayers, not Bechtel, that would be on the hook. So the U.S. taxpayers not only pay with their $87 billion in terms of bankrolling this reconstruction boondoggle, but they will then have to potentially pay again when it becomes clear that these contracts were illegal to begin with.
Are there other countries that are going after the U.S. for doing this?
Well, I think that it explains the silence of Germany, Russia, China. There are countries that are what I think is actually happening, Amy, is that they're hedging their bets, because what they're waiting to see is if whether Bremer is going to respect the contracts that Saddam Hussein signed with Russian, Chinese, and French companies. My sense is that if they will respect it, you know, there have been noises being made that they're not going to respect contracts signed by Saddam Hussein. And my feeling is that if they do go down that route, then you'll start hearing a lot of noise from Russia, France, China, Germany, the countries that whose companies were in there and had those deals. Right now, I think what we're seeing is actually some pretty heavy backroom negotiating. And I think the deal that's being made, frankly, is if you respect the contracts that we signed with Saddam Hussein, then we'll which you could also make an argument were illegal, we will respect the contracts, your equally illegal contracts, being signed by the occupational authority. And I think that the position of a genuine anti-occupation movement should be that neither should be respected, that any new free sovereign Iraqi government should not be saddled either with the debts and contracts of their dictator or of their occupier.
And Bremer's own insurance company wouldn't insure?
No, Bremer, and, you know, before Bremer had this gig, right before, he, after September 11th, a very entrepreneurial guy, he started, and, you know, you've done segments on this on Democracy Now!, he started a company selling political risk insurance and terrorism risk insurance. So, you know, he would say, you know, you're doing business in a risky country, it's a risky climate, you know, buy insurance to protect yourself against political risk and against terrorism. But even his own company will not insure any company going into Iraq, which is why U.S. taxpayers are actually selling them insurance, but they don't realize it.
Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, author of Fences and Windows, dispatches from the front lines of the globalization debate, and her book, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies. Her piece appeared in The Guardian of London, Iraq is Not America's to Sell. When we come back, Al Franken, author of Lies and the Lying Liars That Tell Them. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! That was Milud. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, close to 2,000 people gathered in Madison, Wisconsin, for the National Conference of Media Reform, saying nothing less than the future of democracy is at stake if the concentration of media outlets continues unchecked. On Saturday night, close to 1,800 people packed the Orpheum Theater in Madison. Among those they heard was Al Franken, author of Lies and the Lying Liars That Tell Them. He was recently sued by Fox over his title, and he talks about what happened. This is Al Franken.
It's done very well, the book, and a lot of thanks go to a little organization known as the Fox News Channel, who sued me. It was a lot of fun, and I thought I'd tell you the story, a little bit about the story of the lawsuit, because it's just people enjoy hearing it, and I enjoy telling it. It started in Los Angeles. At the end of May, I was at a book expo on a panel. It was talking to booksellers, to Molly Ivins, Bill O'Reilly, and I were there to plug our books that were coming out in the fall. Molly was there for her book, great book, Bushwhacked. Bill was pushing his book, Living with Herpes. Very, very good book. All writers should really, you know, write from their experience, and it's a good book. It's a very, very good book. And I was there to push my book, and Bill didn't like the fact that he was on the cover of a book called Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. So Molly spoke, then he'd spoke, and he decided he'd go after me. And he said, I don't call people liars. I don't do that. Evidently, he's never seen his own show. And he evidently also didn't realize that it wasn't his show, because I got to get up after him and talk. And I felt I owed him an explanation why he was on a book with the words lies and lying liars. And so I did. And basically, just reading from Nexus transcripts of his shows, I proved that he's not only a liar, but kind of a pathological liar. And he didn't like that. He didn't like it. Although everybody else seemed to enjoy it, he didn't like it, and he said, shut up! You've had your 35 minutes, shut up! And it was interesting, because I'd only spoken for 20 minutes. He couldn't even tell me to shut up without lying. But he was angry. He went on radio the next chance he had on his show and said, if this had been the Old West, we would have had a shootout. Which I thought was interesting. But the most interesting part was that he guaranteed to his radio audience, to his listeners, that he would win. He would have won the shootout. I thought, well, I didn't know quite how he could guarantee that, but he did. And it's really odd to me, especially because some of you may know this, but during the summers I do the whole state fair quick draw circuit. And I'm actually third in the nation, and I know that Bill's not first or second. But nevertheless, he guaranteed to his audience that he would win the shootout, and, quote, I would have shot Franken between the head. It's a quote. See, O'Reilly's like the schoolyard bully who hits a whole bunch of kids, and then a kid comes up to him and hits him, and he goes, "Teacher, teacher, sue him." And so Roger Ailes, Fox, sued me. Well, actually, first what happened was we got a letter from them threatening to sue us. And my publisher was a little upset and nervous about it, and she told me. And I said, look, I've been doing this for 30 years. Don't worry. Satire is protected speech, even if the object of the satire doesn't get it. I said, our letter back to Fox should be, dear Fox, please, please, please sue us. So this made her feel better, and she got Floyd Abrams, one of the preeminent First Amendment lawyers in the country, who wrote them a letter. It wasn't the please, please, please letter. It was, dear Fox, this is the United States of America letter. So I thought it was all over. I was, and a couple months went by, and I finished the book, and then went on vacation, and I was on vacation happily, and they sued me. They sued us. You know, and it was great. It was just great. They're printing the books just as they were suing us. And so we went to court, and Fox was literally laughed out of court. Now, normally when you say literally laughed out of court, you mean figuratively. Not here, not here. The Fox attorney opened the hearing this way. She said, Your Honor, the Fox News Channel has over 85 million subscribers. When the judge said, I don't know what that means. I get cable. Does that mean I'm a subscriber? And she said, yes. And the courtroom burst into laughter, and they were laughing. They were laughing for the next 20 minutes. 20 minutes of just laughing at the Fox lawyer.
Al Franken is author of the best-selling new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a fair and balanced look at the right. He is speaking at the Orpheum Theater in Madison, Wisconsin.
And he looked at the Fox attorney and he said, there are hard cases and there are easy cases. This is an easy case. Your case is wholly without merit, both factually and legally, and it's highly unlikely that your trademark, Fair and Balanced, is actually a valid trademark. And as soon as they could, Fox withdrew the case so they wouldn't be stripped of their trademark, their ironic trademark, which I didn't know whether I was being sued for using Fair and Balanced, the slogan, or the idea of it being used ironically. I didn't know which concept I was being suit on. I just... So... And you'll notice they don't use fair... If you watch the Fox News channel, which I would not recommend, that they do not use fair and balanced very much anymore, and because it's embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. But I think the judge may have inadvertently given them their new slogan, the Fox News channel, wholly without merit. But actually, the University of Maryland did a study, and they may have given them this wholly without merit slogan, too. This is by the Program on International Policy at the University of Maryland, funded by the Ford Foundation. And they did a study on Americans' misperceptions and how they correlated with where they got their information on the war in Iraq. And they tracked three misperceptions. First one was that there was proof of a connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. The second was that we have found weapons of mass destruction. And the third was that world opinion was in favor of our invasion of Iraq. Now, they found that 80% of the viewers who got their news primarily from the Fox News Channel believed at least one of these three misperceptions. And they found that people who listened to or got most of their news from and watched PBS, Bill Moyers, and NPR, people got their news primarily from them, 23% held one of these three misperceptions. But the best part of the statistic, best finding was that the more you watched Fox, the more likely you were to have one of the misperceptions. In other words, the more you watch Fox, the stupider you got. Now, Bob mentioned Rush being in rehab, and we're all praying for him. No, you have to. If someone's addicted to drugs, you have to have compassion for them. And and even though Rush called my friend Jerry Garcia when he died, just another dead junkie and a dirtbag, and just because Rush said throughout his career, that anyone who uses drugs illegally should be prosecuted and put away. You have to pray. You have to pray for him that when he'll get into recovery and go to meetings. And, of course, take responsibility for his actions and for what he's been saying, so that I'm sure that, and I'm praying, that when he gets out, he will demand that he be given the maximum sentence. At the most dangerous prison in Florida, and that he shares a cell with, well, say, an African-American prisoner who saw his comments about Donovan McNabb. You know, you have to pray. You have to pray. People have asked me why. By the way, people have asked me about this. You know, am I doing a radio show? I'm hoping to do it. I'm going to try to do drug-free radio. Evidently, it's very hard. It's what we may call it, drug-free radio. I guess, I don't know if it's been done. You know, it's, that's what we're going to try to do it that way. So these guys, they, part of my book is, basis of my book, there's a right-wing media, and they shill for this administration. And Fox is part of that, Rush is part of that. Here's an example. This is from August 26th from Britt Hume, also on Fox News Channel, from his Grapevine segment of his show. It's a quote. He said, 277 U.S. soldiers have now died in Iraq, which means that statistically speaking, U.S. soldiers have less of a chance of dying from all causes in Iraq than citizens have of being murdered in California, which is roughly the same geographical size. The most recent statistics indicate that California has more than 2,300 homicides each year, which means about 6.6 murders each day. Meanwhile, our U.S. troops have been in Iraq for 160 days, which means they are incurring about 1.7 deaths, including illness and accidents, each day. Well, yeah, but also the most recent statistics show that there are 34 million people living in California, and there are 133,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, which actually means that our troops in Iraq are about 65 times more likely to be killed than citizens in California. And for each one of our soldiers who's killed, five or six are wounded in Maine. Now, when this was pointed out to Britt, his response was, this was in the Washington Post, he said, admittedly, it was a crude comparison. But it was illustrative of something. And I agree, I agree. It's illustrative of how shameless these guys are. I'm going on my fourth USO tour at Christmas. I'm going to Afghanistan, I'm going to Kuwait, I'm going to Iraq. We love our troops. We love our young men and women in uniform. Don't let anyone tell you that we aren't more patriotic than them. Come on. Don't let them tell you that. And I love performing for our troops because they have the sickest sense of humor of any audience I've ever worked to. And they will love what Britt had to say. They will love it. They will find it hilarious. And, you know, and I never like to use someone else's material without crediting them, so I will, of course, credit Britt. So, Bill O'Reilly was on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air. And he walked off, and he said he was treated unfairly, and he was
asked tough questions. Teacher, defund them.
He went on the air The next day, and said that PBS and NPR get $1 billion from Congress. He just makes, is this on the radio? Makes stuff up. Okay. Just pulls it directly from his bum. Now, the NPR ombudsman was so scared that he criticized Terry Gross for asking too tough questions. And I don't know if he listened to the same interview I did, or maybe doesn't know Bill O'Reilly, because O'Reilly lied throughout the interview. And I'll give you one that made me kind of angry. She asked him about this Harper's article where he had interviewed Jeremy Glick. Amy Goodman talked about the people in the World Trade Center, and Jeremy Glick had lost his father in the World Trade Center and had signed a petition against the war in Iraq. And that really made O'Reilly mad and said, I want this kid in here. I want to talk to him. So he had Jeremy Glick on, who's a PhD candidate at Rutgers, and Jeremy was against the war and said that Bush had wanted, pointed out that he had funded the Mujahideen and those kind of things. And O'Reilly got very angry and told him to shut up! Shut up! That sound familiar? And he turned off the kid's mic. And that was the end of the interview. And then, Sun Radio, right? He said, according to Glick, who told Harper's, and Harper's, and O'Reilly hasn't denied this, he told Jeremy, he said, get the F out of here, or I'll effing tear you apart. Now, Terry Gross asked him about this, and he said, O'Reilly said, did you read the transcript of the interview? She said, well, I read the Harper's thing. Yeah, well, that's what the elite media does. They didn't have the whole transcript. They took it out of context. That's what they do. You see, this kid said some outrageous things. He said Bush 1 and Bush 2 had orchestrated. Bush the Elder and this president had orchestrated 9/11. Well, as a journalist, it was my duty to ask him if he had any proof, and he didn't. That's defamation. Well, I had written about this in my book, and I had read the transcript of that, and Jeremy Glick never said anything of the sort. So here's a man, who's got a lot of power, and he defames. Jeremy is a PhD candidate at Rutgers. He makes his money by writing. It's hard to get a gig. He wrote me. He emailed me. He said it's kind of hard to get a gig when people think you're a conspiracy nut. And here's a guy, he's a powerful guy, and he attacks a kid with no platform. And the question is, what do we do about that? Well, it's why I wrote my book. We have to take what they say and expose it and use it against them. My job is to sort of do jujitsu. When they lie, use it against them. Hold them up to scorn and ridicule. Because what they want us to do is to shut up. They want you to shut up. But don't shut up.
Don't shut up. Stand up. Stand up and fight. Stand up and fight. Everyone here, stand up and fight. Thank you.
Al Franken, author of the best-selling new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, speaking at the Orpheum Theater to almost 2,000 people this past Saturday night in Madison, Wisconsin, at the National Conference for Media Reform. And we'll be bringing you more speeches and discussions from that conference through the week. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC. NBC. CBS.
CNN. Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
At ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Myron, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
And that is Media Wars, Danny Schechter and Polaris One. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. A Pakistani cleric who spent a year detained at Guantanamo Bay is suing the U.S. and Pakistani governments for $10.4 million for his, quote, illegal detention, torture, and humiliation. His lawyers claimed he was mentally and physically tortured and kept in a cage that was meant for animals. 53-year-old Mohammed Sagir filed the petition in an Islamabad court last Tuesday. He's suing the U.S. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and the Justice Department, as well as Pakistan's Interior Ministry. In the first case of its kind, Sagir said he wants to be compensated, quote, for the losses I suffered during a year of captivity and mental anguish, adding, quote, I am a poor man. He's the father of 10 sons and 8 daughters. Mohammed Sagir says he was arrested by Uzbek warlord Rashid Dostum's forces in Afghanistan in 2001, soon after the Taliban's ouster in northern Kunduz province. The BBC reports he's emerging as one of the first eyewitnesses to grave human rights violations by the Northern Alliance forces. I spoke with Mohammed Sagir's lawyer last week, Mohammed Ikram Chowdhury, along with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. We reach Mr. Chowdhury in Islamabad and ask him to describe the lawsuit.
See, basically, this is a case of its own kind, very unique, because nobody so far has come out with the kind of sufferings and the atrocities committed on innocent people in Afghanistan and elsewhere by the Dostum and U.S. forces. So I think this was a cause which must have been pursued. And when I was contacted after studying the proposition, I decided that an innocent citizen, duly declared innocent by the investigating agencies in Guantanamo Bay, must have compensation and damages for illegal detention, torture, mental and physical sufferings of his own and his family members. And I think he has a legal justification for that.
Could you tell us a little bit about the tortures and the treatment that he's alleging occurred in Guantanamo Bay?
While he was there, he was put into steel cages of 6 feet into 6 feet into about 6 to 7 feet height. And it was a solitary confinement of his own and other inmates of Guantanamo Bay. While he was put into those cages, in the earlier days, he was practically chained and handcuffed not permitted to move around much, not entitled to any prey, etc. A very poor food and a very little time, about approximately 10 minutes time was given for all that was to be consumed. He was, in the early days, of course, not allowed to move around. So this was initially a basic interrogation when started. He was questioned about the Taliban, Mullah Omar, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. He told them that he was basically on a routine preaching mission along with his 10 colleagues in province of Kunduz in Afghanistan in the month of Ramadan, that was in November 2001, when he was arrested by the Dostum forces. And of course, he was physically chained, and along with 250 people, he was taken to Shabargan and Mazar-e-Sharif. Now, during this journey, once he was put into a container along with other 250 inmates, whereas the container could only afford the transporting of about 60 to 70 people. So the consequence was that being suffocated, about 50 people died on their way being transported from one destination to another. He also told me that on one journey, there was bombardment, and some of the people who had been arrested, they were buried, and some of the injured alive, they were also buried there. While he was in Shabargan jail in Afghanistan, he was, along with many other hundreds and thousands, in all, he said that he saw about 20,000 people during this journey of about 4 to 5 weeks time before he was flown from Kandahar to Guantanamo Bay. So during this period, U.S. Army soldiers, they were also guarding them in jail and outside, and of course in Kandahar too. No medical aid to any sick man, so some of them died over there. Very little food and water was afforded to them. A Red Cross team did visit Shabargan jail, but all that was handed over by them for the prisoners was never handed over to the inmates. It was retained by the Dostum forces.
He was
Muhammad Saghir told me that while he was in Guantanamo Bay, he was twice put into a dark, cold chamber. Once for 8 days, and second time it was 14 days. And during this period, practically his body practically was frozen because of the chill air which was blown into those into that room. So in this way, according to him, he suffered a great humiliation. Many a time he was abused in Afghanistan by the U.S. forces in Kandahar. He, along with others, their beard were shaved, mustaches were shaved, their heads were shaved, and they were physically given thrashing a few times. So this was practically about a year and a month or so, a period of physical, mental torture and humiliating phenomena which he underwent. He saw the living people being buried, injured people being buried alive. This was heartening. And he was under constant fear of death and physical and mental torture. So these are the events of atrocity committed by the Dostum and U.S. forces, and of course by the U.S. official who are manning Guantanamo Bay prison.
In Pakistan, under what provisions or what laws are you able to file this claim? Because it is being filed in Pakistan, not in the United States, right?
See, basically, United States airplane came here and brought him to Islamabad airport. So we have partial cause of action here. And I have also implicated Interior Ministry, which is responsible to safeguard the rights of the citizens in Pakistan and, of course, abroad. So this is a lawsuit under the law of damages and compensation, and this is being tried by a civil court, which is situated in the premises of district courts at Islamabad, the federal capital of Pakistan.
Mohammed Ikram Chowdhury is Mohammed Sagir's lawyer and an advocate in the Supreme Court of Pakistan in Islamabad. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is the largest public media collaboration in the country as we broadcast on more than 170 Pacifica radio and affiliate stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, and Free Speech TV, the oldest nonprofit progressive TV channel in the country. That's Dish Network Channel 9415. And if you have friends or family who do not have Democracy Now! In their community on TV or radio, you can tell them to go to our website, check it out, see where we're broadcasting, and they can ask their radio or TV station, public access TV station, to broadcast Democracy Now! Our website, again, democracynow.org. where you can also go to sign up for our daily digest that lets you know the kind of news we're covering. And for those of you who are watching on TV, if you're wondering about our new surroundings, we've just changed the angle a bit because we're undergoing renovations here at the firehouse of Downtown Community Television, and we are sure to be going through more unusual, fascinating changes in the weeks to come. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagari, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim, our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Orlando Richards, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, John Randolph, Chris Zucker, Dennis Moynihan, Eric Romemu, Jenny Filippazzo, Isis Phillips, Carmen Walsh. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.